This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley in Maryland. There is a lot going on in the country right now, but we have to start in Minneapolis. And we're grateful to our Across America partner station, Minnesota Public Radio, for bringing us an update on what's happening there. Brant Williams is a reporter with NPR and joins us now. Brant, thank you so much for making time for us.
You're welcome.
So last night, a police station in Minneapolis was overrun and set on fire by protesters. It was the third straight day of demonstrations over the death of George Floyd. Video surfaced this week of a white police officer kneeling on Floyd's neck during the arrest. Floyd later died in custody. Police had claimed that George Floyd physically resisted officers, but that cell phone footage shows Floyd lying pinned and handcuffed for nearly 5 minutes while repeatedly telling officers that he can't breathe. So, Brant, you have been at the protests. What are you seeing? I mean, first of all, how much of the city is affected by protests, and what are the crowds like?
So this morning, we're just seeing, as the dawn is risen over Minneapolis here, that there are still fires burning of businesses. The corridor of Lake Street runs along a west-east-west axis in Minneapolis. It runs about 5 or 6 miles. The epicenter near the third precinct is where the most damage is, but we're getting reports that further west down Lake Street, there are more businesses that have been set on fire. I live about 3 miles from that third precinct building, and a couple blocks off of Lake Street. And yesterday I went out to see that there were businesses near the intersection of where I live that were also broken into. So it's the damage is spreading, as you've probably seen in the footage and news photos. National Guard members are now out on that particular part of Lake Street, but I haven't seen the National Guard spread out wider than that immediate area.
So let's hear from the mayor. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey spoke with reporters. He carried on a news conference on Thursday.
The emotion-ridden conflict over last night is the result of so much built-up anger and sadness. Anger and sadness that has been ingrained in our Black community, not just because of 5 minutes of horror, but 400 years. If you're feeling that sadness and that anger, it's not only understandable, it's right.
So, Brant, how has the response been, not just from the city, but from authorities in general, from police and from the state?
So, there's a lot of things that have been different about this particular incident. One of them, as we've mentioned, is the response from the mayor calling for the arrest of the officers, police chief immediately firing the four officers involved. We've been also hearing from the state board, which mandates training procedures for police officers. They released a statement this week saying that the knee on the neck of a person is not a sanctioned use of force. And I've also been hearing from law enforcement officials, current and retired, who have told me that they were shocked by the video themselves, that this is something that they were never taught to do as police officers. So that's unusual. We're seeing this immediate response from law enforcement. People in the community are, as you can imagine, as well as being frustrated and outraged over this incident, they've been feeling this building for so long. And while many of the folks that I spoke with over at protests and at the vigil over the past several days have not necessarily pushed for violence, they said they can understand where it comes from. As that this has been building for so long in Minneapolis. I'm sure you're aware of some of the other high-profile fatal police shootings in the city. Jamar Clark in 2015, the death of Justine Ruschek, who was a white woman killed by a Black police officer, also drew a lot of attention and outrage as well. So it's been brewing here for so long. People are feeling at the frayed edge, and we're not sure how much further this is going to go.
You mentioned, Brant, that the four officers involved in George Floyd's death have been fired, but is there any indication they may be arrested on charges?
Still no word on that yet. The investigation by the FBI and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension are still going on. The Hennepin County Attorney, Mike Freeman, has been trying to basically put a damper on people's expectations about how things can go down. But if you hear from people like the mayor, like Mayor Fry said, he's seen what you could say is probable cause for an arrest and holding pending formal charges. Yeah. But that's it's a tough process when it comes to police officers. You're probably aware of, you know, there's a Supreme Court precedents that basically gives police officers that authority to use lethal force if there's a threat. And so those are all legal issues that will have to be dealt with during the legal process here. Again, this could take weeks. And if protesters say they're going to keep things up until there are arrests, then we could still see more protests, more violence in the weeks to come.
Let's bring another voice into this conversation. Jane Costin is a senior politics reporter for Vox, and among many topics that she covers is white nationalism and race. Jane, thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
One thing that happened just this morning was that a CNN reporter and his production team were arrested in Minneapolis while covering the protests. Can you update us on what happened?
So the CNN reporter was in the midst of a shoot, and he was apparently, it's interesting because all of this took place on CNN. The reporter's name is Omar Jimenez. He was arrested this morning while covering the protests and taking place in Minneapolis. He had asked the police where he should be moved to, and rather than telling him where to be moved, he was arrested, even while a colleague of his who happened to be white was just a block away and was not arrested or not subject to the same type of policing. Fortunately, he's been released from police custody, and he was now back on the air. But he, alongside with a producer and a photojournalist, the producer is Bill Kirkos, the photojournalist is Leona Mendez, were all arrested by Minneapolis police for the crime of reporting.
And Brandt, you're there reporting on these protests. Do you have concerns about covering them and whether or not you might encounter the police?
I have not had any run-ins with police. I haven't been down at the Third Precinct protests where a lot of the disturbance has been happening. Last night I was out in downtown Minneapolis. There's well over 1,000 people who were marching through the streets. At the time that I was there, it was peaceful. There were no police hanging around watching that I could see. There were some sheriff's deputies outside of the Hennepin County Government Center who just stood watch. They didn't interact with the protesters. But there's always that concern when you're out. And, we do carry press badges to make sure that we're identified as members of the media. Sometimes, as we saw with the CNN reporter, that doesn't always help. But yeah. It's something that I think all reporters keep in the back of their mind as they're out reporting on these events.
Jane, I wanted to ask you about something Brandt mentioned earlier, which is the difference in response over George Floyd's death that compared with other responses. There is a long list of unarmed black people who've been killed by police officers, and yet we have seen not only an immediate but very different response, especially among police officials. Why do you think that is?
I mean, I think I would hope that this is the straw that broke the camel's back because, you know, this at the same time that we're having a conversation about Minneapolis, there were hosts of protests in Louisville last night as well, which resulted in the shooting of 7 people, not by police as far as we know. And they were reacting to the death of a woman in her own home. She was shot 8 times by narcotics detectives who may at best have been in the wrong home. And so I think what we're seeing in Minneapolis is not just the result of one act of police brutality, but dozens and dozens. You know, this is still the same city where the killer of Philando Castile was able to get away with it because he argued that if you know, if Castile had used marijuana in his car, who knows what he might do in front of his daughter. And so I think what you're seeing is the reaction to this happening time and time and time again. You know, Minneapolis police have had a series of incidents. Even the officer involved in the murder of George Floyd has a lengthy background of brutality that has not resulted in any sort of, you know, discipline coming from the police department. So I think what's happening is that people are reacting not just to this death, but to the deaths and the injuries and the slights suffered by so many people.
And demonstrations are also happening in New York, Los Angeles, Phoenix, Columbus. In fact, the Denver State Capitol was put on lockdown after protests there. And as Brent Williams suggested, we may see the protests in Minneapolis continue until there are arrests. That's what has been said anyway. We've been talking with Brent Williams, a correspondent with Minnesota Public Radio. Brent, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Still to come, we'll continue this conversation with Jane Costin of Vox and bring in the rest of our News Roundup panel to talk about the other top national headlines this week. I'm Celeste Headlee. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor LegalZoom. LegalZoom makes it easy for Americans to set up their estate plans without leaving their homes. Don't know the difference between a last will or living trust? What about an advance healthcare directive? LegalZoom can help. They're not a law firm, but you can get started quickly online and also get advice through their network of independent attorneys. Learn more about estate plans and how you can speak to an attorney for advice at LegalZoom.com.
The news has been hard to escape. So take a deep breath and join us for NPR's All Songs Considered. It's more than a music discovery podcast, it's relief, with new episodes every Tuesday and Friday as we share the week's best new albums and lots of music to calm the nerves. Hear All Songs Considered wherever you get podcasts.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, and joining us to talk about the week's top national stories, Jane Costin, senior politics reporter for Vox, Lisa Lehrer, a politics reporter for the New York Times, and Carol Lee, correspondent with NBC News. Let's return to our discussion of not only the protests in Minneapolis, but the death, the murder that sparked them. Carol, the Department of Justice has said that its investigation into the death of George Floyd is a, quote, top priority. And President Trump asked the DOJ to expedite an investigation into Floyd's death. What does that all mean?
Well, it means that from the president's perspective, he's trying to intervene in the sense that he give people assurances that the Justice Department is taking this seriously, that his administration is taking this seriously, and that he recognizes that there's a lot of pressure and desire for a swifter resolution than may have happened otherwise. The problem with what the president is saying is that he since undermined his own message with a tweet overnight around 1 a.m. this morning, where he said that he essentially fanned the flames by saying something, repeating a phrase from a 1967 Miami police chief about during the civil rights era about the looting, saying when the looting starts, the shooting starts. And that has now overtaken anything that he has said previously. He started out saying things like he was going to expedite the investigation, that this was a horrific tragedy. He was briefed by the attorney general and the deputy FBI director yesterday at the White House. And now he's really pivoted towards urging more, inciting more conflict rather than urging calm.
Let's talk about this tweet from the president. He had previously called the video of Floyd's death shocking, but as you say, he sent out a tweet that called the protesters thugs and said, quote, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, end quote. Twitter attached a warning to that tweet. They not only attached a warning to the original tweet from the president, but when the White House account retweeted it, they attached a warning to that as well. Twitter said it violated the company's rules about glorifying violence. And Jane, Carol mentioned that this has a very specific historic connotation, that phrase, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. What's the history of that?
So it stems from the late 1960s, and it stems from a Miami police detective who essentially said that He wasn't concerned about police brutality. He actually, you know, hoped to be kind of blamed for police brutality. And the police chief, Walter Headley, essentially said that, you know, we haven't had any problem with civil rights because, you know, he's had the word filter down that when looting starts, shooting starts. And, you know, he thought that during the civil rights movement, there were 10% of those involved who were, quote unquote, taking advantage of civil rights. And he said that, you know, there were organized gangs of young Negroes and essentially called it a get tough policy, which, you know, in December of 1967 was perceived as being the right strategy. You know, he even said things like felons will learn they can't be bonded out from the morgue. And so I think that it's interesting because he, in that time, saw his actions as being, you know, kind of the last stand. He said that community relations had failed. We did everything we could. And I hope that listeners can hear the air quotes I'm using there. But saying that, you know, shooting was the only thing that people would understand. And it's a clear hearkening back to the type of law and order rhetoric that we heard from Trump in 2015, 2016, and that we've heard time and time again from Democrats and Republicans since the early 1960s, that, you know, that in order to curtail these protests, the protests that are coming as a result of the overreaction by the state, that we, you know, that police need to get tough, in effect, causing more violence.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, because of these new steps Twitter has taken, President Trump signed an executive order Thursday that's designed to limit legal protections that shield social media companies from liability. The president said this order would, quote, uphold the free speech rights of the American people, end quote. Can you give us more details on exactly what this order does?
Yeah, so basically the president signed an executive order that seeks to change a federal law that has really spared tech companies from being sued or held liable for a lot of posts and videos shared by users on their sites. And the law is known as Section 230. And basically what it says is that website operators, which could be anything from Twitter to Facebook, YouTube, blogs, you know, comments that people post, are not treated as a publisher or the speaker for making other people's posts, you know, putting them on the internet, so they can't be sued. Now, the president has argued that that law, that Section 230, allows those social media platforms to censor conservatives. And that's something the companies deny, but something that's, you know, a very prominent charge echoed not only by the president, but by, you know, Republicans in Congress and conservative activists. But really, this was a response to Twitter fact-checking a claim that he had made over the weekend, falsely insinuating that Joe Scarborough, the television host, murdered a congressional aide. Twitter put a fact-check on his tweet, and then a few days later, the president came out with this executive order. The irony of this whole executive order is that the president really built his political career on Twitter. He is the politician that learned to use social media in this mobilizing way that really no other politician had cracked the code on before. And he's done it, you know, by putting these posts with basic impunity, you know, by never being, this is the first time Twitter has fact-checked one of his posts. So in some ways, you could really argue that he's been a major beneficiary of Section 230 and of this whole law. So it would be interesting if this executive order were to be put in place, which lawyers say may not happen, the president himself could face lawsuits.
So we got this tweet from Rob who says, I'm deeply disturbed by the president and now the White House's comments about shooting looters. Every time there's been a major event in America, I'm in awe of the president's response. I'm at a loss for words. And in response to the executive order, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey says he will not back down and will continue to point out inaccurate information on Twitter. But Carol, we got this question from Pat who says, please correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't Twitter a company? It can choose to provide service and deny it to whomever it wants. What's the answer for Pat?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think when it comes to, it's a company that obviously is designed to have as many people as possible operating on its platform. And I think when it comes to President Trump, one of the arguments that him and his allies have been making about Twitter is that they're intentionally singling him out. And let's be clear, this is a political fight that the president relishes in, this idea that big tech companies like Twitter are trying to squash conservative speech. This is something he's talked about for a long time. One of the things that the White House is arguing is that when saying that President Trump is being singularly targeted, is that Twitter is not then going after things like the Supreme Leader in Iran or other false statements from various places. And so now there is a broad standard, or Twitter is at least setting itself up for a broader standard of labeling tweets all over its platform.
Yeah, it labeled some tweets from the Chinese government as well.
Correct. Right. And so there are much larger implications than just President Trump.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to leap in quickly because I think that it's important to note that Section 230, which is part of the Communications Decency Act, was passed in 1996. It is more so about the difference between the content that you and I post on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or SoundCloud, and that differentiating from content that's created by Twitter or Facebook. If Facebook releases a statement, they could be sued over it. If I post to Facebook, they cannot be sued over what I post. But I think that we've heard from a host of Republicans and Democrats, you know, when you have Senator Josh Hawley and Joe Biden on the same page about how bad 230 is, I think that there's been a real misunderstanding, a weaponized misunderstanding about what Section 230 is. Section 230 is why that there are comment sections on websites at all. Section 230 is how the internet has been created as we know it. Yeah. And Trump is well aware that, you know, he said something yesterday about trying to shut down Twitter. Trump loves Twitter. He's well aware of that. But what I find most interesting is that Trump thinks that this is a great election gambit for him, but just 22% of Americans are on Twitter at all. And that's including people who use it all the time and including people who never use it at all. And most of Trump's voters aren't on Twitter and don't particularly care about Twitter at all. So it's interesting to me that this is a, you know, this is an election gambit. It won't work with the courts. It doesn't understand the law that it's attempting to be reforming. But it's also aimed at the extremely online, who were not the people who were supportive of Trump back in 2016.
Well, let's move on to another different kind of encounter that went viral over social media this week on Twitter and Facebook and other places. It was an encounter between a black man and a white woman in Central Park. Christian Cooper was out bird watching in the park. He asked a woman there to leash her dog. Her response was to call 911 and claim that an African-American man was threatening her. This is after she sort of charged him. Cooper filmed the whole innocent incident on his cell phone. It quickly shot across social media platforms when his sister posted it. And I wonder, Carol, this has raised this question about when 911 is called, especially when white people call the emergency line on a black person doing something harmless. And this also has a long history behind it. How is this debate going?
Well, one of the things that I found very interesting is Christian Cooper's response himself. The New York Times did a story this week on him where he was really taken aback and surprised at how quick the reaction was and retaliation against the woman who called 911 on him and essentially said that he's not excusing racism, but he didn't think her life needed to be torn apart like this. So this instance is actually quite interesting in the sense of the conversation is just that has spun out of it is different than other conversations, national conversations that we've had about these sorts of issues. And he seemed to be, and again, it speaks to how swiftly things like this, it's only in modern history that an incident like this can really be brought to light that quickly and that broadly.
Yeah.
Let's
take a listen. Both Christian Cooper and his costers named Amy Cooper, there's no relation between the two of them, have been interviewed. Here is a bit of Christian Cooper's interview with NPR's All Things Considered.
I can't tell you whether or not she's a racist. I can tell you what she did in that moment, and it was a moment of, you know, stress and of confrontation and of, you know, probably spectacular poor judgment. But in that moment, what she did was definitely racist. Now, should she be defined by that, you know, couple of seconds moment? I can't answer that. I think that's really up to her and what she does going forward.
But Lisa, a few days after that incident, there was a video of a white man in Minneapolis, again, Minneapolis, threatening to call 911 on a group of black men in a gym that they belonged to. And that went viral as well. And so it has raised this concern about who calls 911 and whether or not 911 is being weaponized.
Right. And then what happens if, you know, the police arrive and, you know, is there disparate treatment based on your race, which, you know, we're seeing that, of course, explode in Minneapolis yep. right now. I think this is part of a conversation about race the country has been having. And it's a conversation that's really become inflamed in the Trump era, in part because the president is not playing the traditional role that presidents usually play when there's these big national conversations about heated issues, particularly those around race or other sort of cultural issues, which is to sort of come in and find a way to try to bring the country together or add to, you know, a constructive dialogue. You know, the president has an ability to sense these conversations and just kind of inflame them and try to weaponize them to his own political gain. We saw that in 2016, where studies showed afterwards that a lot of people cast their ballots not on economics, but on their feelings about race. And so I think what we're seeing in these incidents is that they remain heated, a heated part of the American conversation, even in the midst of a global pandemic that has a lot of people stuck at home or, you know, really nervous about or facing real economic or health hardship, that this is going to be part of our dialogue going forward and probably will be a conversation that's only going to grow more heated as we move closer to the presidential election.
So, Jane, we got this comment from Marsha on Facebook who says, we're in the process of becoming a form of far-right authoritarian ultra-nationalism characterized by dictatorial power and forcible suppression of opposition. There's a lot of trauma going on right now. And I wonder what you make of how we're handling all this. Because in the midst of all of this unrest and outrage over issues that have lasted for a very long time, we also have, as Lisa mentioned, a pandemic going on. How are we doing?
We're not doing great. I think, you know, 103,000 people have died from coronavirus in this country. And I think that the fact that we have not been able, it's been a very challenging experience for a lot of people because it has been so slow moving. You know, I've compared it to if you watched a tsunami that took place over months at a time. And I think that there is a sense that, you know, for many people that this is all too much. This is all taking place for a lot of people at a time when they are already scared. They haven't seen friends or family. They may have lost friends or family and been unable to go to their funerals. And so I think that it's one of the challenges here is that, you know, we can't stop for a pandemic. Politics doesn't stop. Culture doesn't stop. The weaponization of race and racism, unfortunately, doesn't stop as a result of a pandemic. I think that there were many people who kind of hoped that we could pause on all of our disagreements during this time, but that's impossible. And I think that what we're seeing is an attempt by people to work through all of this at a time when we can't really work through it together in person. Yeah. And that's particularly challenging. I know this has been a really hard week for me, you know, as a black person observing all of this taking place. You know, I just keep thinking, you know, I've been trying to avoid places with televisions that show that the murder of that poor man over and over again. And it's uniquely challenging to be doing this at a time when we need to be socially distanced from one another, when we can't gather together in the same ways that we might in order to come to terms with this in some way. Yeah. And especially when we are attempting to even have normal political conversations. I've heard people saying, you know, what do you think this means for November? Yeah. And I'm like, I'm trying to figure out what it means for tomorrow.
Yeah. Jane Costin is a senior politics reporter for Vox. Lisa Lehrer, a politics reporter for The New York Times. Carol Lee, correspondent with NBC News. We'll hear more from you and from our guests in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Facebook. It's a challenging time for small businesses in communities across the country. Facebook's Business Resource Hub offers free tools to help manage a business, support customers and employees, and connect with other business owners who are facing similar challenges. From information on how to bring a business online to setting up a customer service plan, Facebook's Business Resource Hub can provide resources. Learn more at facebook.com/resource.
There's no getting around it. The coronavirus pandemic has upended everything. And daily decisions made by the White House and Congress will radically impact the human and economic toll. To keep up with the latest, join us on the NPR Politics Podcast. We'll cut through the noise and let you know what decisions are being made and how they affect you.
We're talking about the week's top headlines with Jane Costin, senior politics reporter for Vox. Lisa Lehrer is a politics reporter for The New York Times. And Carol Lee is a correspondent with NBC News. Well, this week marked a tragic milestone in the United States. The coronavirus pandemic has now claimed more than 100,000 lives. And Lisa, it is difficult to get your mind around that large of a number. That's more than the number of people who died in the 9/11 attacks and American casualties in the Vietnam War combined. Can you help us put this in context?
It's also this. It's as if everyone in Albany, New York, or Flint, Michigan died over the course of a season. I mean, it's equivalent to the population of those cities. So it's a huge number, and I think it's been a number that's been really hard for Americans to wrap their head around, not only because of the size, but also because of sort of how disparately it's hitting communities. We know that it's disproportionately hitting communities of color. It so far has been disproportionately impacting cities. So your experience of this pandemic can really vary widely depending on who you are and your socioeconomic status and where you live. And so it hasn't really been a unifying experience for the country. The other thing that I find really striking is that there's really been no national mourning. This is a huge number, and the country hasn't had a formalized way to express their grief. And look, you know, America is a country that has a lot of ways to mourn. We build monuments, and we hand out gold stars, and we hold moments of silence, and we have all these different rituals that leaders use to help the country mourn and sort of create a feeling of solidarity and common purpose for whatever challenge may lie ahead. And we just haven't seen that. And we certainly haven't seen it from the White House, which said yesterday that they have no plans for any kind of commemoration. Joe Biden put out a video address that was sort of designed to look like an Oval Office address. And it did, but, you know, a video address on social media, there's something that feels sort of inherently small about that when you contrast it to the kind of things the country did after 9/11. And Congress, it's really the same sort of situation. The House had a moment of silence yesterday, but there hasn't been any kind of bigger ritual coming out of Congress. In part, social distancing, of course, makes organizing those kinds of things challenging. But, you know, if politicians wanted to do something, I'm sure their political strategists could find a way. They certainly do in all kinds of other situations. So it has been striking that we haven't really had that experience. And I think that has been something that has not really helped the country. The fact that there hasn't been this kind of larger national event around this pandemic, you know, it hasn't really helped the country process what's going on.
Since we're speaking about a tragic loss and memorializing those who died, the world lost a prominent and pivotal AIDS and gay rights activist this week, Larry Kramer. The playwright and author was praised for his 1985 autobiographical play, The Normal Heart. Kramer will be remembered for the protests that helped force the government to address the 1980s AIDS epidemic. And here's just a bit of a 2006 interview with CBS Sunday Morning with Harry Smith.
It's hard getting up in front of people making an ass of yourself. But, you know, you got to think of the greater good.
So you almost said it.
What?
As tough as you seem to be, from those of us watching from the outside, and as angry as you were, it was also a lonely fight.
It's always a lonely fight. Life is lonely.
But what a way to live.
People, it's a great way to live.
Yeah?
Why? You can wake up in the morning and say, I wasn't a phony, I wasn't scared, I fought the fight.
Longtime AIDS researcher and current director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, Dr. Anthony Fauci, often came under fire by Kramer back then, but they became friends later in life.
I'm very sad that we've lost him. He was just an extraordinary man. He changed totally by his extraordinary iconoclastic and theatrical ways of doing things. He changed the relationship between the afflicted community with a given disease and the scientific and regulatory community that has such a great impact on them. He said, you can't be separate. You got to keep us in the tent. we've got to be in there with you.
That was how Dr. Fauci remembered Larry Kramer to PBS NewsHour's Judy Woodruff. Kramer died in New York on Wednesday. He was 84 years old. Let's go back to a look at politics and the intersection with social media. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg weighed in this week on President Trump's very public fight with Twitter. So here's just a portion of Zuckerberg's interview on Fox News this week.
We have a different policy, I think, than Twitter on this. You know, I just believe strongly that that Facebook shouldn't be the arbiter of truth of everything that people say online. I think in general, private companies probably shouldn't be, or especially these platform companies shouldn't be in the position of doing that.
Lisa, this is more of what we've heard before from Zuckerberg, right? Twitter and Facebook often do not agree on these issues, but it does seem like Twitter's new policy is a major split away from Zuckerberg's way of thinking, right?
It is a major split, and I think it reflects how the companies are taking different paths as they come under greater scrutiny. Before the pandemic hit, of course, there was a really strong sense that these companies were going to come under regulation. They've been hauled before Congress a number of times. It seemed like we could see in polling that public sentiment was turning against them in some ways. People were starting to be concerned about how much information these countries had about them, and that was sort of catching on as more of a political issue. We now see Donald Trump, using Twitter, running against Twitter, so he's setting them up as sort of a new kind of enemy in American society, along with the press and Democrats and other groups that he continually goes after and in his remarks. So I do think this was building, and as a result, you see these companies sort of striking out on different paths. The question will be what happens once the country gets through this moment of national crisis, where how we communicate online has become a much bigger part in so many people's lives, whether the companies still face that same kind of scrutiny.
And Jane, we mentioned earlier that despite the fact that we're in the midst of a pandemic and all of these things are going on that are serious, Democrats accuse the president of using these Twitter fights and especially the conspiracy theories that the president has been threading about MSNBC host Joe Scarborough. They say he's using this as a distraction from the bad news that's going on in the country. How has the president used distraction in the past? Is it possible the Democrats are right?
I mean, I think that there's been a lot of conversation about trying to understand the president's motives for things, and that is not generally something I try to get into. I think that to believe that this is 12-dimensional chess is giving the president perhaps far too much power than he actually has. I think that this is what interests him. This is what affects him personally. He is more interested in the, in the ins and outs of fighting with Twitter, a platform he loves and loves to hate, than he is in dealing with a long-running, slow-moving pandemic that appears to be hitting some of the country harder than the rest of the country. And I think that, it is a distraction. I don't think that that is his, I think it's a distraction to him. I think that, there are a host, I talk to people who are, for my job, I talk to conservatives and right-leaning populists all the time who are thinking, he could be doing something else. He could be increasing payments made to people who are out of work. He could be talking a lot about, rebuilding the American working class or the middle class after this pandemic. He is not doing that. He is signing executive orders about people being mean to him on the internet. And so I think that, yes, it is a distraction, but it's a distraction for all of us. It's a distraction for him. I don't think that this is part of an overall electoral strategy, because I think that that would require too much effort on his part. I think this is simply what interests him most.
So we got an email from Victoria who says, I just want to encourage Twitter and give them credit for at least taking ownership of our lying government. They too have a responsibility to not allow abuse by bullying and lies that hurt their own citizens. Earlier this week, the president threatened to pull the Republican National Convention from Charlotte, North Carolina, where it is scheduled to be held this August. Trump criticized the state's Democratic governor, Roy Cooper, for not guaranteeing they could fully occupy the arena convention space. Tuesday, Governor Cooper responded to President Trump's tweets.
I'm not surprised by anything that I see on Twitter. I will say that it's okay for political conventions to be political, but pandemic response cannot be. Already, We've been in talks with the RNC about the kind of convention that they would need to run and the kind of options that we need on the table. We're talking about something that's going to happen 3 months from now, and we don't know what our situation is going to be regarding COVID-19 in North Carolina.
So, Carol, in response, the Republican governors of Florida and Georgia offered to host the Republican National Convention. Do you think it's possible the convention could be moved on such short notice?
Well, it would be a very heavy lift to do that. Our reporting shows that President and Republican officials who are involved in the planning are really trying to keep it in Charlotte, that's the desire. And, we were reporting back in April that the president's team was in discussions about how to scale down the convention because of the pandemic. That when the president got word of that is obviously not something that he wanted to see happen. It's not the message that he wants to send in his campaign. People social distancing on the floor of the convention and, not having the big scale party that he wants. And so he issues this threat, and he set this sort of arbitrary deadline of Tuesday for the governor to make a decision on whether or not he can accommodate the convention. And it looks like there will be some sort of accommodations, and it will likely stay there. If not, though, I've talked to officials in Florida who've said that they are actively looking at ways to try to host this for the president. There's a couple mayors who've said that they are open to that. Because of things being shut down, there's potential for hotels and venues and things to be open in a way that they might not otherwise be in the middle of the summer. But this is also something that the president is looking to, in part, to be able to blame Democrats for not having the convention that he wants in it. And it's of a piece of this broader effort that we've seen from him to really create a divide between, we saw it at the start of the week with just wearing a mask, whether on that issue. And this is kind of also in that same vein. But the people around him, that they've invested tens of millions of dollars in North Carolina, the number of cases are going up there. There's a realization that it's not realistic to not have some sort of modifications. And our reporting shows that they would really like to keep it there.
Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, GOP lawmakers sued House Speaker Nancy Pelosi because of remote voting. Lisa, what is the basis of this lawsuit?
Well, they're saying that it's a change. It's changing 231 years of House custom, and they're challenging whether it's constitutional under Article 1 of the Constitution that says that you need a majority quorum for the House to do business. But clearly, politics are at play here, and this gets into what Carol was just talking about, which is that the response to this pandemic has become sort of our new culture war. It's about masks and do you wear a mask or not has become, a guise for some partisanship. And we see that in the polling as well, that Democrats and independents are much more likely to say that they would wear a mask and they feel masks are necessary than Republicans. So I think this extends to that, how much social distancing is required to keep this pandemic at bay, and how you feel about that question in part depends on what your seems to be correlated in some part with what your political views are.
Jane, before we wrap up the domestic part of our news roundup, I just wanted to kind of go back with an overview of all the upsetting things that are happening right now, from the protests in Minneapolis over the death of George Floyd, from the protests in Louisville, to the pandemic. What is needed at this moment? Is it possible, looking back through political history, that we need a leader to emerge to sort of take the reins? Or is this going to be more of a group American populist solution?
I think it will have to come from the populace. I'm very concerned about the idea of one unified leader coming to rescue us from this situation, which sounds more like the plot of a Marvel movie than how American politics has worked traditionally. Look, sometimes I think that when people talk about race relations, there's an idea of race relations being good or bad. But polling shows that in the early 1950s, most white Americans thought race relations were fine. People were, polled very optimistically about race relations because their understanding of what that meant was very different from African Americans and non-white Americans subjected to Jim Crow policies. I think that this is a part of an, we are roiling in ways that we have not had the opportunity to do so in recent years. We are roiling in a sea of information that we have not had access to before. And we're also experiencing more than ever the experiences and opinions of people who are different from us because of social media platforms and because of a news environment that shares stories from across the country and nationalizes local news. You know, I think for many people, if you were growing up in 1967, 1968, you may have heard of what happened in Chicago in 1968, but it wouldn't have seemed so searing across the, you know, newscasts, because if you weren't living in Chicago or weren't watching the one nightly news program. Yeah. So I think that this has been taking place for decades in this country. You know, this isn't the first time that a police officer has murdered a person. It is among the first times that a police officer has been caught on film doing so in front of, you know, dozens of, you know, people in person and in front of the viewing public. So I think that there is no leader who can save us from ourselves. There is no one person who can do this. This is just what we are facing for now.
Jane Costin, senior politics reporter for Vox. Lisa Lehrer, politics reporter for The New York Times. Carol Lee, correspondent with NBC News. Thanks to all of you. 1A's socially distant lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. We'll turn to the international edition of our news roundup right after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, and it's time for the international edition of our news roundup. We have a lot to talk about, including claims about a secret plan to sell more arms to Saudi Arabia, a controversial car trip that's making life very tricky for the British Prime Minister, and also why Russia sent camouflaged fighter jets to Libya this week. Also, the struggle throughout Central and South America to contain COVID. It's a lot. My guests on the roundup this week are Karen DeYoung, associate editor and senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Ron Nixon is international investigations editor for the Associated Press and author of Selling Apartheid, South Africa's Global Propaganda War. Thanks for joining 1A, Ron.
Thanks for having me.
And David Lawler is world news editor at Axios. Hi, David.
Great to be with you.
Let's begin with China. Chinese lawmakers approved a bill this week that will undermine Hong Kong's autonomy. That was the explicit takeaway, as articulated by U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, that legislation is now fueling a new wave of anti-mainland China protests in Hong Kong. So, Karen, what exactly happened this week?
It certainly has brought to us head this long-running and escalating controversy between the United States and China, first over trade, then over virus.
Karen, I'm going to cut you off here just for a second because your mic is cutting out a little bit. So while we get that solved, Dave, can you explain what this bill does that the Chinese lawmakers approved and how it relates to Hong Kong's autonomy?
Sure. So this is coming explicitly from Beijing. They're essentially asserting control over security in Hong Kong. So this is expected to ban things like sedition that are interpreted quite broadly by China and could be enforced arbitrarily. So people in Hong Kong see this as, you know, not even sort of the more subtle encroachment on their autonomy that has led to protests in the past, but quite a forceful assertion by China that they're in charge in Hong Kong. And obviously the U.S. reaction is that this means that Hong Kong is no longer an autonomous territory.
And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo told Congress this week, quote, no reasonable person can assert today that Hong Kong maintains a high degree of autonomy from China given facts on the ground. President Trump is expected to hold a press conference today, possibly announcing actions against China. Ron, what has been the reaction, not just in the U.S., as we heard, but from other nations internationally?
Well, there are several other nations that chimed in along with the U.S., expressing concern. The U.S., Britain, Canada, and Australia all criticized Beijing for the security bill and saying that, you know, Hong Kong has flourished as this sort of basin of freedom, but that they have expressed deep concerns about Beijing's decision to impose this national security law there. And they went further by saying that it curtails the freedoms that the people in Hong Kong enjoy. As you know, that this is Hong Kong has this sort of operates in some ways separate from mainland China, even though it is a part of China. But that has raised this concern from these other countries that this is Beijing's way of really taking a stronger role in the city.
So, Karen, what happens if the U.S. does revoke Hong Kong's special trading status?
Well, I think that, you know, Hong Kong is sort of the way the international and particularly the U.S. financial system gets into China and the way China gets out of China, so that it kind of allows avoidance of sanctions. It allows avoidance of a lot of the restrictions on dealing with China. And so I think that it makes it hard for both sides. And so that's, I think, why it certainly makes it hard for both sides if the United States takes action as a result of this. In other words, what Pompeo is saying is we can no longer deal with China through Hong Kong, with Hong Kong as a relatively autonomous place where the international financial system works without restrictions, if China is going to impose these measures. Therefore, that cuts off China from all kinds of things, but it also cuts the rest of the world off, which has a lot of investment in China and a lot of investment from China.
And Dave, is it possible that other countries might follow America's lead, especially in terms of changing trading status between Hong Kong and China?
Yeah, it certainly is possible. We have to see exactly where America is trying to lead first. So I think that's why the details are going to be very important here, because, you know, obviously for the people of Hong Kong, they are hoping to maintain some level of autonomy from China. Increasingly, that is in doubt. And obviously Pompeo is putting that in pretty stark terms. But if the U.S. does decide we're not going to treat Hong Kong any differently from the rest of China, the question is that effectively giving up on the idea of Hong Kong as autonomous and, you know, giving up on those freedoms that existed in Hong Kong? One fairly dark perspective I heard on that is we can't change what China is going to do in Hong Kong. You know, they've asserted their intentions at this point, so we just have to put a stake in the ground and not kind of go along with the charade. But it is a pretty worrying, you know, when you think about what's actually going to happen in the city of Hong Kong itself, it's quite a worrying development.
A spokesperson for the Commissioner of China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Hong Kong has called America's criticism and possible response, quote, utterly imperious, unreasonable, and shameless. But Ron, what has been the reaction of people in Hong Kong? Maybe not the government, but we know that Hong Kong has seen a lot of protests and unrests. How have the people of Hong Kong responded?
Yeah, I think this is what you see here is with the protest is similar to the protest that you saw in when China tried to enact a national security law. And then last year, where they tried to this extradition law that would allow people in Hong Kong to be extradited to mainland China to face whatever charges. And so they see this again as just sort of more of an encroachment upon the freedoms that they enjoy in Hong Kong.
So what happens next, Karen? Do we wait for more word from China? What are we waiting to see?
Well, you know, the Chinese came out with a very strong statement this morning saying that they would take what they called countermeasures against the United States if the administration attempted to punish them. Right now, what we're waiting for is what President Trump is going to say. And I think there's a very broad range of things that he could do, beginning with saying that Chinese students at U.S. universities would have to be vetted for any connection to the Chinese military or intelligence services. This would be, there are hundreds of thousands of Chinese students, university students and graduate students in this country. They contribute billions of dollars to the U.S. university system. There's some talk that he could find individuals to sanction who the United States determines have been responsible for the actions against Hong Kong, all the way to some kind of financial restrictions. Again, cutting back on Hong Kong as the kind of entry point into the Chinese financial system and China's exit point to the rest of the world. So we just don't know at this point. There's a lot of support in Congress to be tough on China. As you mentioned before, there are other countries, Canada, the UK, Australia, who have come out again and said, you know, we want strong action against China. So I think we just don't know yet what the president is going to do and how China will react to that. There's danger for both countries in taking strong measures.
Dave, in a minute, I'm wondering if you can answer this question from a Kokomo kid. Wants to know, would these new rules have been put in place for Hong Kong had the demonstrations a few months ago not become violent?
So that's an interesting question. Obviously, the motives in Beijing are kind of hard to access, but we do know that obviously China is attempting to assert its sovereignty, its control here. It wants to show that it's in charge. And I think that is a direct result from what we saw last year. Now, blaming the violence and the protests in Beijing's attempts to gain control is a slightly trickier question. I think a lot of the people in Hong Kong would say they were driven to that point by what China had already done. But, I mean, you could say, given the scenes that the world watched last year, China was pushed towards this step.
So worldwide, the United States has been an unfortunate leader in daily coronavirus deaths, except on Monday. That's when Brazil's official daily death toll surpassed the U.S. for the first time. That came just a day after the Trump administration banned flights from Brazil, citing the country's surging coronavirus crisis. And on Thursday, Brazil reported a new daily record of more than 26,000 new coronavirus cases. Ron, there have been questions about the information that we're receiving about COVID-19 in Brazil. What do we know now about what the coronavirus crisis actually looks like there?
I don't think we have any better information, but the numbers that we do have show that the virus is definitely having a deadly toll in the country. And it's significant because the president, Bolsonaro, has downplayed the pandemic there and ignored the warnings from various public health officials there and even sort of mocked the attempts to practice social distancing. But the numbers that we do have show that it is having a devastating effect there, which is why the Trump administration imposed this ban on flights coming in from Brazil.
Karen, how big of a deal are these travel restrictions? Is travel to other countries banned as well?
I think that you mean from South America? I think
no,
that
from the U.S., yeah.
Yeah, well, there's still a ban in place from China and from parts of Europe. I think that, though, this is the first banning from Latin America. There are lots of people who go back and forth from Brazil to the United States. You're looking at, you asked before about the numbers. I mean, they are saying 400,000 confirmed cases, by far the largest in Latin America, but a death toll, which they're claiming now is only 25,000, which I think is widely believed to be a severe undercount. Sao Paulo, which is the biggest city in the hemisphere, has a huge, huge problem. And there's a lot of concern that Bolsonaro And to some extent, the in comparison with Trump, which is who he's been compared to before, is not taking it seriously. He's dismissed it as the flu, a cold. Big cities in Brazil, like Sao Paulo, Rio de Janeiro, have very, very crowded lower-income areas, no protection. Hospitals are packed, and I think that the feeling is that it's just going to get worse. Bolsonaro has started hinting that, you know, well, maybe we should go back to military rule, which, again, is a sort of, it's sort of the Brazilian version of the United States. Weren't things better in the 50s when things were calm? Of course, you had a military dictatorship in Brazil until the mid-80s, and people say, oh, yes, weren't things calm back then?
Dave, there has been a warm relationship between the Brazilian president and President Trump. It's something that the president in Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, has bragged about. This travel ban, does it possibly indicate that that relationship is going cold?
So Bolsonaro has certainly taken some flack from opposition lawmakers about, you know, you've spent all this time essentially sucking up to the United States, and now look how much it gets you. There was some speculation that the U.S. might even have done this sooner if not for that positive relationship that you mentioned between Trump and Bolsonaro. Interestingly, just as the scale of this crisis was becoming clear in the United States, Bolsonaro was actually in at Mar-a-Lago with Trump, and that led to sort of the first question of whether Trump had been exposed to the virus himself. So there's a bit of history between these two just in this pandemic. But obviously the numbers now, even if we you know, think we might not have the full picture, the numbers we do have from Brazil are fairly staggering. You know, 35% of new cases anywhere in the world are now in South America, the bulk of those from Brazil. So it's a very worrying scenario, particularly with the president, who doesn't seem to be taking it all that seriously.
Well, let's move a little bit north from Brazil and talk about Mexico. A New York Times report this week looked at a major crisis in the hospitals there. More than 11,000 Mexican health workers have been become sick with COVID-19. That's one in five of the country's confirmed cases. Ron, what are we hearing from healthcare workers about what's going wrong in the hospitals?
Well, this seems to stem from a long-term neglect and the public health system in Mexico that's just being exacerbated by the COVID-19 virus. You hear about doctors, according to the Times report, that an experienced nurse, for instance, unplugged a patient's ventilator, or someone died of septic shock because there was no one to monitor their vital signs. And then the doctors and nurses simply lack the protection, the equipment to protect themselves from the virus. So it's having a devastating effect on them, and they're simply watching their colleagues get sick from the virus that they're trying to help patients recover from.
And I wonder, Karen, what we hear then from the Mexican government. That's always the question, right, is not only what is happening online, but then how is each individual government responding?
I think that there's a lot of concern that the government is not responding. As the Times was doing their report, the government refused to respond to them at all. You know, there was concern that when all of this started, people working in hospitals were instructed not even to wear masks because they said it would panic people. It would upset people that this was serious. The government has cut the health budget. As was already said, you know, a lot of the equipment in the hospital is old, fell apart. There aren't enough doctors to monitor the situation. There aren't enough nurses to take care of people. So I think that you know, the response so far has been not very good.
Let's move on. On Tuesday, the Department of Defense accused Russia of sending camouflaged fighter aircraft to Libya. U.S. defense officials called out Moscow for a move that tilts the scales in Libya toward a Russian-backed warlord there. So, David, can we get a quick refresher here on what's been going on in this region? It's been a while since Libya has been in American headlines.
Sure. So there is basically a civil war in Libya that's being waged both by kind of ragtag militias on the ground, but also by foreign powers who are deeply involved. Russia is involved on the side of, as you mentioned, Khalifa Haftar, a warlord there who's based in the east of the country. He's also supported by Egypt and the UAE, among other countries. And then you have the UN-backed government that is backed by Turkey. And nominally by other countries around the world, but not with the kind of force we're seeing come in from the UAE and Russia and Turkey on their various sides. So you have kind of this, obviously oil assets are part of the concern here. It's an oil-rich country that has basically no effective government, and now you have all these foreign powers in there fighting it out amongst themselves.
So, Ron, what is Russia's strategic interest in Libya?
Well, as you said, the oil is certainly one of the there, but I also think that it's about Russia's influence in the region. They've long been there, but haven't really had a have denied their involvement in the region. But it appears to be that it's more about their strategic influence in that region.
So the Trump administration...
I'm having a hard time hearing you. I apologize. I'm...
No worries, Ron. Okay. We're going to talk now about this other story coming out with the Saudis. The Trump administration has been accused this week of trying to sell arms to the Saudis. That's despite a bipartisan agreement in Congress to block any such deal. This was reported originally by the Daily Beast, and then that story was backed up by New Jersey Senator Bob Menendez, that such a covert move seems to be tied to the recent firing of the State Department Inspector General Steve Linnick. Karen, what do we know about these claims?
Well, I think we need to go back a little bit to last year when... probably back even farther to 2017, when President Trump made Saudi Arabia the first foreign trip he took. He was very proud of the fact that he said they signed deals for more than $100 billion worth of weapons, that was going to boost U.S. industry, and it was also going to solidify the relationship with Saudi Arabia against Iran. So most of those deals kind of never came to fruition. And last year, there was... $800 billion worth that the administration sent, as they must, to Congress for approval. And Menendez, the senator from New Jersey, and many others, including some Republicans, said, whoa, wait a minute. We're concerned about Saudi Arabia, what's happening in Yemen, human rights abuses. This actually sort of even goes back to 2018 with the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist, said, we don't want to do this. They passed a resolution saying that that they didn't want to sell arms to Saudi Arabia. That went to the White House. The president vetoed it. So the president then earlier this year decided to declare an emergency saying that the emergency was Iran and Iran's malign activity, which then did not require him to go to Congress, and theoretically the $8 billion in arms went ahead. Now there's another request for arms, which is not so much a secret, but it goes, the way it works is when the administration wants to do an arms sale, they send an informal report to Congress, and Congress says, yeah, we like this, no, we don't like it, we don't like X, Y, and Z about it, and then there's a negotiation, they agree. The administration then sends a formal request, and that goes ahead without any problem because they've already agreed. This time, they sent the informal request for more arms to Saudi Arabia, and Congress once again said, well, no, we don't agree, and there's not really much to negotiate about.
Okay, so going back to Senator Bob Menendez, who verified or confirmed the story in the Daily Beast, Menendez issued this statement on Wednesday. He said, quote, before we went into pandemic lockdown, I received draft State Department documentation that it is now pursuing this previously undisclosed sale, details of which have not yet been made public. Even though the Saudis seemingly want out of their failed and brutal war in Yemen, the administration has refused to answer our fundamental questions to justify this new sale and articulate how it would be consistent with U.S. values and national security objectives. unquote. Just a reminder, there is no love lost between the Secretary of State and Senator Menendez, this is what Mike Pompeo said just over a week ago.
This is all coming through the office of Senator Menendez. I don't get my ethics guidance from a man who was criminally prosecuted, case number 15-155, a man for whom his Senate colleagues bipartisan said basically that he was taking bribes.
So, Dave, why is America's top diplomat going after Bob Menendez like that?
So the root of that particular dispute was about the firing of the State Department Inspector General, Steve Linnick, who, as you know, as you mentioned, was fired while he was investigating this original Saudi arms sale last year. Pompeo was actually on Fox News last night, and he said that he was asked about Linnick's firing, and he said Linnick had been investigating policies simply because he didn't like them, basically. He was, you know, taking it upon himself to do policy from the Inspector General's office. So obviously, we don't know if he was referring to the Saudi arms deal there, but clearly that seems to be something that struck a nerve. Menendez has been pushing this point quite a bit that, you know, Pompeo and the Trump administration have this, you know, relationship with Saudi Arabia that's inconsistent with American values. And obviously, Pompeo took that opportunity to bring up past criminal charges against Senator Menendez. So, you know, pretty acrimonious between Democrats in general and the Trump administration on Saudi Arabia.
I can imagine an argument could be made, though, Dave, that look, the Saudis will buy their arms from somewhere, and perhaps it's better they buy them from the United States than from the Russians or the Chinese. What kind of justification have we gotten from the Trump administration?
So, I mean, the Trump administration has made a very similar argument to the one that you're making, and also that Saudi Arabia is a key strategic ally against Iran. That was why they said they had to rush through the arms sale last year, so that you know, even if you don't like Saudi Arabia, we don't want to lose them. You know, we don't want to lose a partnership with them to more nefarious actors around the world. Now, the reason that Democrats were particularly concerned last year was that a lot of these missiles in particular that were being sold to Saudi Arabia were being used in Yemen without any real, I mean, at least as far as we can tell, discretion about civilian casualties. A lot of concern about how that war was being waged and whether it could even make the U.S. complicit in war crimes there. So that's where the Democrats are coming from. But as you said, the Trump administration says we need to keep this relationship with Saudi Arabia and we need the money for our defense industry.
We are going to hear more from Ron, Karen, and David in just a moment. We'll pause for a moment. Time for something, you might say, completely different. The lockdown has begun to ease up in the UK. And in the meantime, residents in one village outside of London are celebrating with a series of silly walks. Monty Python fan James Ruffle put up a sign outside his house in Sunning, informing people they were entering the jurisdiction of the Ministry of Silly Walks. Now, a sketch. If you have memories, or maybe you're a Monty Python fan, or maybe you live in the UK, there was a sketch made famous by John Cleese and the rest of the Python troupe in the 1970s about silly walks. You can even buy a watch in which the hands of the clock are John Cleese walking very sillily. So, sillily, I'm not sure that's a word. Sonning's Silly Walks are now watchable. You can watch them online and worldwide. And this is an invitation to you. If you are a Silly Walk fan, listen, we want to see your silly walk, right? I mean, we have to. So, send us your videos and we will watch all of them, I promise. We want to see you walking sillily. You can post them on our Facebook page. You can tweet them to us. You can email us as well. It's 1a@wamu.org. So Wednesday, European Union leaders forwarded an economics stimulus package that's worth more than $800 billion. That's not just a chunk of change. It's also a bold move and could fundamentally change the European Union.
A struggling economy in one part of Europe weakens a strong economy in another part. This is about all of us, and it is way bigger than any of us. This is Europe's moment.
That was the Commission's president, Ursula von der Leyen, speaking in Brussels Wednesday. German Chancellor Angela Merkel and France's president, Emmanuel Macron, jointly proposed a similar $500 billion EU recovery fund last week. David, what makes this such big news. Why is Lyon calling this Europe's moment?
So the big factor here that makes this different for Europe is how this is going to be paid for. So this would be paid for by money raised on the capital markets collectively by the European Union and by some EU-wide taxes. So basically, tax and spend policy has been left to individual governments in the past. This would take it upon the European Union as a whole. And so that is why, you know, this rhetoric of the Hamilton moment, that's where that comes from, because it's the idea that we're taking these struggles of individual countries and dealing with them collectively in a way that had not previously been the policy of the European Union.
And Karen, how is this package going to be paid for?
Well, they're going to, as was just said, you know, go to the financial markets. They're going to assess taxes, and they're going to issue bonds. And I think that the interesting thing about this is a lot of Europeans have been fighting for many, many years over whether the EU should be what essentially would be a federal system. Or like in this country, or these are individual states who must all agree on something. And you saw with earlier financial crises, like with Greece, in order to bail them out, they imposed very severe restrictions on them, on Greece, very severe austerity measures. And this would not be the case with these things. This would be just dispersed according to need. And in the same way as Hamilton got the federal government to pay for all the debts that the states had accumulated in the Revolutionary War, the EU would take on the responsibility of making whole those countries who have been particularly hard hit economically by the pandemic. The criticism of this is, well, in the United States, if you don't like what the government's doing, you just don't vote for it anymore. And that the EU leaders who have decided on this, certainly people like von Leyen and others who are in the EU bureaucracy who came up with this plan and the European Central Bank, nobody votes for them. Nobody voted for this plan.
Dave, how likely will we see this proposal pass?
Sure. So you need every country to sign off on this, all 27 member states. There are four countries that have particular concerns. They're sometimes called the Frugal Four because they're not as interested in big spending from Brussels, particularly when it comes to, as Karen mentioned, grants to these countries rather than loans that have to be paid back on specific terms. So, the EU is actually pretty good, given they need 27 yes votes, at getting to a yes outcome on these sorts of things. But this might be, there might have to be some ground given before we get final approval.
We'll stay in Europe. This week, Hungary's parliament voted to ban transgender people from changing their gender or identity on official documents. Karen, why is this now happening in Hungary? Where is this coming from?
Well, I think it is coming from the government of Viktor Orban, which is a populist government, putting it in its mildest terms, and they've tried to do this before, and in fact have done it to some extent before. But what they've now said is that you can only on any official documents you have to be listed as your gender at birth, and people, transgender people and others in Hungary are saying, look, this is going to when people present themselves looking different, perhaps, than what their documents say, it's going to cause them a lot of problems. The larger question is that this government is really trying to legislate these people out of existence, and it clashes with the direction much of the rest of Europe is going.
Dave, let's broaden this out a little bit, because we've talked a lot about in the United States all of the things that are serving as sort of a distraction while the pandemic is going on. How does this happen in Hungary fit in with other things that may be going on in nations that have nothing to do with COVID-19? How do we sort of put this ban on transgender people changing official documents into context?
Sure. So basically, Hungary has already given near unquestionable power to Viktor Orban during this crisis under an emergency law. We've seen similar actions taken in Eastern Europe, places like Serbia. Actually, you know, right nearby, Poland attempted to hold an election during the COVID crisis. They wanted to move it at the last minute to a vote by mail election, but the opposition was able to delay that because basically they said, we can't campaign and you can. So you've seen just in Europe these kind of more authoritarian leading leaders take advantage of the crisis. We've also seen, you know, I mean, what we were talking about earlier from China is a case of a country who's under a lot of scrutiny for their initial handling of this outbreak, but who also feels pretty empowered at the moment, obviously, at a time when the United States is kind of on the retreat, when the global community is quite distracted given what's going on in all of their own countries and is taking particularly aggressive actions on foreign policy. So it's something to watch in Europe, but also around the world.
What do you make of that, Karen? There are accusations in the United States that the administration is using other sort of cultural fights as a distraction from how the government handles or doesn't handle COVID-19. Are we seeing this in other nations as well?
Well, we're seeing it in places like Brazil, which we've already talked about. Certainly in Hungary, we're seeing it a bit in this country. I think that governments that are Venezuela, governments that are authoritarian already in by nature, I think you're seeing them both trying to distract from the pandemic, but also use the distraction of the pandemic and concerns and the desire for a strong government response to promulgate some of these more extreme measures.
So let's consider what has been a week of outrage and anger in the UK because of a very controversial car trip. In April, a top aide to the British Prime Minister admitted driving 260 miles north of London to get childcare for his son, but it took place at a time when the government told absolutely everyone to stay at home, pretty much no exceptions. And yet Boris Johnson is standing by his aide, Dominic Cummings.
I can't give any unconditional backing to anybody, but I do not believe that anybody in Number 10 has done anything to undermine our messaging.
That's the UK's Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, speaking at a press conference on Monday. David, as I mentioned, this happened back in April. Why is it still sparking so much anger?
So the main answer to that is that people feel that they have made enormous sacrifices during the lockdown in the UK, which was actually quite a bit stricter than the lockdown that we had here in most of the United States. People said they weren't able to visit relatives who got sick. If they were sick, they were told very strictly that they had to stay inside. And so the idea is that there was one set of rules that applied to them and another one that's applied to this guy who plays a big role in setting the rules, Dominic Cummings. Another aspect of it, the longevity of this story, as you mentioned, it's been driving news coverage every day for a week now in the UK, is that Cummings himself is a figure of some fascination in the UK. He's viewed as this kind of Machiavellian figure behind Boris Johnson. He was the driving force behind the strategy of the Brexit campaign. He's kind of the ideas man in Downing Street, who a lot of people think is doing more than anyone else to drive government policy right now. And so, you know, it would be odd, I guess, to have a, you know, an aide who doesn't actually hold a, you know, cabinet post or anything like that be the topic of, you know, days and days and days of coverage. But part of that is the role that Cummings himself plays in Boris Johnson's government.
And Karen, Boris Johnson has been fairly adamant about standing behind Cummings, even with all the blowback that's happening in that country. Why? What relationship between Cummings and Johnson might justify that? Or is this just part of the overall response Johnson has had to any criticism of his response to COVID-19?
Well, you know, this is such a classic British kind of upheaval, and something like this incident. There have been so many things that have happened in this country. I think if something similar happened, it would just completely blow over. But remember that Cummings was the sort of architect of Brexit. He's not a well-liked person. He's someone who is thought of as kind of snide and who doesn't play by the rules. And so you had the timing of this, where you had Johnson, who had not like the rest of Europe, brought Britain into a lockdown until he himself got sick. He gets sick, 3 days later, Britain's on lockdown. A couple days after that, all of a sudden, Cummings shows up in Durham, in the far north of England. He says, well, I had to get childcare because he and his wife were both testing positive for the disease. And the rest of Britain said, wait a minute, we need childcare too, but we're observing the lockdown. So in some sense, as was just said, I think it's just overall frustration. But in other ways, people really don't like Cummings. And I think that Johnson's somewhat cavalier attitude toward this, he called it a political ding-dong about what one advisor may or may not have done, has sort of eroded a lot of the sympathy that was felt for Boris Johnson after he himself got sick.
And that may be part of why it continues to stay in the headlines. But David, I wonder if there will be political fallout from this. I mean, yes, there's been days of coverage, but is this the kind of thing that could stick to Boris Johnson and to his party that could cost them?
I think the answer is yes, to a degree that was surprising to me initially, especially as Karen mentioned, given the just this pure number of scandals that we've lived through under the Trump administration, none of which seem to stick to Trump particularly. But in this case, the initial polling suggests that people are starting to lose confidence in Boris Johnson. As Karen mentioned, his approval ratings shot up, during the sort of rally around the flag moment in the UK, particularly when he himself got sick with coronavirus. But we're now seeing confidence in his response scrutiny over the numbers, which are particularly devastating in the UK. One of the highest death rates in the world. They haven't bent the curve in the way that Italy and Spain, other hard-hit countries, were able to earlier. Yes, I mean, I think that this is something that is sticking to Boris Johnson and that may lead people to look at him slightly differently. I mean, I saw a particularly cruel column in The Guardian that said Boris is unwilling to fire his ideas man because he doesn't have any ideas of his own. But that's kind of the take that a lot of people who might already have been suspicious of Boris Johnson have during this scandal.
All right, we have just like a minute and a half or so, so I can give both of you, I know Ron is having some technical difficulties, but Karen and Dave, maybe you could each tell us a story that we haven't talked about that you think is crucial right now. Dave, you want to start?
Sure. So I'm looking forward to this rocket launch, which we hope will happen tomorrow, this SpaceX launch. One thing I think is interesting is what it means for the relationship between the U.S. and Russia in space. For the last 9 years, the U.S. has had no choice but to hitch a ride on Russian rockets to get up into space, and that has really helped fund the Russian space program. Now they're sort of going their own separate ways, and this one area of cooperation between the U.S. and Russia is suddenly kind of in doubt. So that's something that I'm watching over the weekend.
Karen, can you give us a 30-second story we've missed?
Well, I've been doing some work on Venezuela, which crisis there goes on. The U.S. Problems with Venezuela go on. And this week you've had a number of ships transporting refined gasoline from Iran to Venezuela, according to the United States, in violation of all kinds of various sanctions and stuff. And so you've had controversy over whether the United States was going to do anything about this.
Yeah.
So far, they haven't done anything. A couple of Iranian ships actually did arrive and unload their cargo. Ships that fly other flags, particularly Greece, have sort of said, we don't want to mess with this, and have turned back around. So
Big thanks this week to Karen DeYoung, whose voice you just heard, senior national security correspondent for The Washington Post. Ron Nixon had a few technical difficulties. He's international investigations editor for the Associated Press. And David Lawler, world news editor at Axios. Before we go, this is a tough time. And yet for more than a month now, you have shared with us your stories about acts of kindness, and we want to share them as well. Today's story comes from Jean in Conway, New Hampshire.
Here in the Mount Washington Valley, there's an organization called Gems Friends that does amazing work to support anyone in the valley undergoing treatment for cancer. Each spring, Frank and Carol Ann Dahlmeier, owners of Bagels Plus, organize and run a major fundraiser for Jen's Friends. This year, because of the social distancing restrictions, the annual scavenger hunt had to be canceled. Despite their own hardships due to the revenue loss from the partial closure of their bagel shop, the Dahlmeiers held a 24 hours for Jen's Friends on May 22nd. 100% of the proceeds and tips that they brought in that day were donated to this local cancer-fighting organization.
That's a great story, Jean. Thank you so much for sharing it. 1A's socially distant senior producers are Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. I Zoom with them every Friday from my home studio. Our sound engineer and designer, Jake Cherry, is my other Zoom buddy. Matthew Simonson produces our podcast, all part of an outstanding team who helped make all of this happen. This program comes to you from my house and WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend. Stay safe, and thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.